And I understand there's a big holiday coming up this weekend, Queen's Day. So I regret that I won't be here to enjoy it, but hopefully I'll be enjoying things in other places. Hey, I want to start off by giving you this URL. If you've been in my other sessions, you have it already. It's the same one. But if you want copies of all the demos, code samples, and things I've been showing, you can go to this URL, winelect.com/download/devdays2011.zip. And download that zip file with copies of everything that I've done this weekend, a little bit more, as a matter of fact. Hey, before we start, let me show you something here. So, you would never guess, but I live in the United States. I'm not a native Dutch speaker. I live in the part of the States that was hit by the tornadoes and the storms a couple of days ago. This is my son's Jeep. You can see all the puck marks, almost like bullet holes. That was from balls of hail about that big falling. So thousands and thousands of cars are damaged. My home is damaged a bit, but no one I know was seriously hurt. The death toll's over 300, so I actually feel quite fortunate, but got a lot of work when I get back there. Good thing I'm a Silverlight developer. That makes fixing things like this easy. So I'll bring this URL back up at the end. So my final session here, it's going to be a fun one, I hope. It's entitled Tips, Tricks, and Techniques for Building Killer Silverlight Apps. And what I want to do here is show you a few things that I think are very, very important for Silverlight developers to know. One of the things I do for Microsoft is inside the company, I teach Silverlight classes and HTML5 classes and advanced Silverlight classes. This actually comes from a session that I do for Microsoft developers. In my opinion, a few of the most important things that you need to know if you're doing real-world Silverlight development. Most, not all, but most of what I'm going to share with you has to do with doing things dynamically in Silverlight that are normally done statically. And a lot of those have to do with factoring your applications. And the subtext behind a lot of what I'm going to show you is that you never, ever, as a Silverlight developer, want to deploy large monolithic ZAP files. If a ZAP file is 200 or 300 megabytes, that's too big. It takes too long to download the first time. It makes the user wait too long for that application to run. Because, as you know, until that ZAP is downloaded, Silverlight doesn't do anything but show you a splash screen. Somewhere up in the 300 to 400 megabyte range, Silverlight can't load a ZAP that large. It will throw an out-of-memory exception first. And yet, it's not obvious oftentimes to a Silverlight developer how to factor the application. How do you break an application into multiple ZAP files and just download the pieces you need? How do you only download assets and resources that you need when you need them? It's not hard to do any of this. It's just not something that's written about and talked about a lot. So I want to show you this. And in fact, although I do have slides prepared, we're going to spend a lot more time in Visual Studio in this session, even doing some live builds, than we are in the slides. The very first step that I want to introduce to you is how to do dynamic assembly loading in Silverlight. Doing it is not a difficult thing to do. We can always use a web client, for example, to download an assembly asynchronously using Silverlight's networking stack, and then we can use the assembly part class to load that assembly into the app domain. And once it's loaded into the app domain, it's just as if it had been included in the ZAP file. Core CLR and its JIT compiler are aware of the types in that assembly, and those types are accessible to you with or without reflection. If you've ever been told, yeah, you can do dynamic assembly loading in Silverlight, but only if you're satisfied with using reflection to access the types inside the downloaded assemblies, you've heard wrong, because you can do all of this with the benefit of strong typing, as I will demonstrate. And to demonstrate, I'd like to go immediately over to Visual Studio, and I'd like to build something for you so that you can see step by step how this comes together. So we'll fire up Visual Studio. We'll create a new Silverlight project. And I'm going to make this a Silverlight 5 project, but it would work exactly the same in Silverlight 4, even in Silverlight 3 for that matter. I'll call this Assembly Load Demo. Choose Silverlight Application as the project type. We will let Visual Studio generate a web project to go with it. And now we have an empty project, or at least we will in a moment. Now I'm going to start out by doing something very simple. In mainpage.xaml, I'm going to declare a calendar control. Now, you may be aware that the calendar control is not part of the core Silverlight runtime. To use it, you have to add a reference to your Silverlight project to an external assembly named system.windows.controls.dll, which is all fine and good, but there is one downside. That does increase the size of your ZAP. In fact, having lots and lots of externally referenced assemblies are one contributor to ZAP bloat. So we're going to add a reference to that assembly, system.windows.controls. Now we should be able to use the types inside it, but if we want to instantiate those types in XAML, we will need to give the XAML parser a little bit of help, and we'll do that by adding an XML namespace prefix here. Let's call it controls, and we'll point the XAML parser to system.windows.controls, to that namespace inside the assembly of the same name. I should now be able to declare instances of calendar controls and other controls in that assembly. So far, so good. It looks like Visual Studio and IntelliSense know about the calendar type. That's a good sign. And I'll also set a width and a height on that calendar. And when we run it, hopefully we'll see a little calendar sitting right there in the middle of the browser window. Let's make sure that much works before we go further. And there's our calendar. Now, there's nothing hard or sophisticated about that. But let's change it up a little bit. I'm going to get rid of the calendar control. And I'm going to replace it with a button control, like this. We'll give it a width and a height also, maybe 150 and 100. Hopefully those proportions will look good. For content, on the face of the push button, we're going to write create calendar, like this. And then we're going to let Visual Studio write a click event handler so that we can execute some code when that button is clicked. Now, let's go over to that event handler. First thing I'm going to do in it is write a line of code to get rid of the button. So we should be able to do this. I'll do a layout root.children.remove. And we can pass in a reference to sender, since sender is the button, but we'll have to cast it to a framework element or UI element to satisfy the compiler. That should do it. Now I'm going to dynamically create a calendar control. So let's do this. We'll do calendar. We'll just call it cal equals new calendar. And let's give it a width and height, just as we did in XAML a moment ago. And, of course, if we want the user to see that calendar control, we're going to have to add it to the visual tree. So this time I'll do a layout root.children.add, and I'll pass in a reference to that calendar control that I just created. And if that works now, we'll see a button when the app starts up. We click the button should disappear, and a calendar control appears in its place. So, still no big surprise here. But let me submit something to you. We now have an example, albeit in a very simple form, of an application that is wasteful. Because if the user never clicks that button, then we don't need system.windows.controls.dll. Why make them pay the price for downloading that if they're not going to use it? And in a simple way, this is representative of a lot of real-world Silverlight applications, larger, more complex applications whose resource requirements depend on how the user interacts with the app. Wouldn't it be nice if we could get system.windows.controls.dll out of that ZAP file and pull it down if and when we need it? Well, let's see if we can make that happen. So here's what I'm going to do for starters. One thing that I can't do is simply remove that reference from my project, because then my code would no longer compile. The compiler would have no idea what a reference to a calendar type means. But what I can do is select that reference, then go down to the properties window and change copy local from true to false. Now, an interesting thing happens when I do that. Watch, I'm going to rebuild the project, and the compiler is satisfied because it did compile. More importantly, if you go look in the client bin folder and look at the ZAP that was created, that ZAP no longer has a copy of system.windows.controls.dll. So it almost seems as if we've gotten a free lunch here, but we all know that there's no such thing as a free lunch, right? What happens when we try to run this thing? Just because it builds doesn't mean it works. Now, I know you've tried to tell your boss differently sometimes, but let's see what happens when we try to run this thing. So there's the button. And here's the exception. If you look at the unhandled exception there, the error message, CoreCLR is telling us that it could not find system.windows.controls.dll, which isn't surprising given that the calendar type lives inside it And when we tried to create a calendar type, the only way this code could work is if somewhere, somehow, a copy of that assembly had been loaded into the app domain. It's not there. So clearly, we're going to have to do a little bit more work if we are going to make dynamic loading work. So let's go back and take the next step. And here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go into that click event handler for the button. Now I'm going to do pretty much what you saw on the slide. I'm going to, after removing the button from the visual tree, I'm going to fire up a web client object like this. And I'm going to register a handler for the open read completed event that's going to fire once the asynchronous download has completed. I'll hit tab a couple of times and let Visual Studio write an empty event handler for me. And then I'll write a line of code to actually put the asynchronous request out on the wire to go download system.windows.controls.dll. So we'll do an open read async. And now I'll have to pass in a URI telling Silverlight where to go to do the download. I'll pass in a relative URI, system.windows.controls.dll. And I'll have to tell the runtime what kind of URI this is. It is a relative URI. And of course, right now that URI is meaningless. I'm going to have to post a reference copy of that assembly up here in my client bin folder. So let's do this. I'll do add existing item on that folder. And then I'll go find a reference copy, which I should find under program files, Microsoft SDKs. So let's go to Silverlight version 5. We'll look for the client-side libraries, and here we should find system.windows.controls.dll. So this relative URI now resolves to this file on the server, and now what we should be able to do is this. Let's take the code that creates the calendar control, and let's move it down into the open read completed event handler. But we're still going to have to load the assembly into the app domain before we try this. So here's what we'll do. We'll new up an assembly part object, just like I did in the slides. Tried to use the Dutch spelling there. Did you see that? Two S's. Assembly part. We'll just call it part equals new assembly part. And then I should be able to call assembly part.load. Now, what it wants as input is a stream. But I can get that stream containing the downloaded assembly from the stream, or actually the result property of the event args that's passed in. And just to make this robust, by the way, let's do this. Let's make sure that we only attempt to do this if the download of that assembly was successful. I can check that by saying if the error property of that event args is null, that means everything proceeded as I expected, then I'll do the loading of the assembly into the app domain. Otherwise, and we hope not to go here, but I'm going to use messagebox.show to display an error message, and we'll get that error message directly out of the exception object in that error property. Again, I hope not to see that execute. I expect this to execute. Let's see what happens. So now, I run it. I click the button. When I click the button, a web client is used to do a download of the assembly. The assembly is loaded into the app domain, and the calendar control appears right there in place of the button. There is a calendar control on the screen behind me, isn't there? No, there's not a calendar control. Oh, that's strange. We got another exception. And the really strange thing is that if you look at the error message, it says, could not load file or assembly system.windows.controls.dll. But wait a minute. How could that be? My download succeeded. Otherwise, I would have seen an error message pop up. So maybe the code didn't execute. Maybe I should put a breakpoint in that open read completed event handler and see what's going on. Well, let me tell you what would happen if you put a breakpoint on that handler. The breakpoint would never be hit. That code that loads the assembly into the app domain and attempts to create the calendar control is not being executed. The reason why is one of the best reasons I know of why even a Silverlight developer benefits from knowledge of .NET and CLR internals. Let me tell you what's happening here. When I write Silverlight code in C#, as you're well aware, that code is being compiled into IL. IL, before it can be executed, has to be jitted into native machine code. So the very first time that method is called, my open read completed event handler, Core CLR hands the IL off to the JIT compiler and says, compile this. In order for the JIT compiler to turn the IL into native machine code, it has to be able to resolve all of the type references inside the method. Well, the JIT compiler goes through the method, it sees a reference to something called calendar, and to generate the machine code, it looks into the app domain saying, okay, where does the calendar live? Which assembly can I find it in? But there is no such assembly. And the JIT compiler doesn't know how to go find that thing for itself. So what you're seeing here is an exception from the JIT compiler. The reason the method is never being executed is because of that one reference to calendar inside it. If part of the method can't be compiled into native machine code, none of it can. So we have a classic chicken and egg problem. The very method that's loading the assembly into the app domain is never being executed because we reference a type in that method that requires an assembly to already be loaded in the app domain. So is there a way around this? There is. There are two steps involved. One is pretty obvious. The other is not nearly so obvious. Here's what I'm going to do. Let's create a private helper method. We'll have it return void. We'll call it createCal. And what I'm going to do is take this code that creates the calendar type or calendar instance and move it down to there. Then I'm going to call this createCal method from the open read completed event handler. Now that has solved one problem. Because createCal returns void, when the JIT compiler compiles that open read completed event handler, it doesn't see any references to calendar, and therefore it can JIT it and execute it. Now here's the kicker, folks. If I were to run this right now, it would probably work. But it's not guaranteed to work. And in fact, if it does work, it's something of an accident. It may work here, but if you run the same thing on a Macintosh, it may not work. Let me tell you what's going on. The JIT compiler in Silverlight is identical to the JIT compiler in the Big.NET framework. In fact, you may or may not know that CLR for the Big.NET framework and core CLR for Silverlight come from the same source code base. There are a lot of ifdefs in there, but they do come from the same source code base, and they have the same JIT compiler. The JIT compiler in the Big.NET framework and in Silverlight reserves the right to optimize your code by inlining short methods. Well, createCal is a short method. It's three lines long. If the JIT compiler on one platform happens to decide to inline it, I'm right back to where I started. Therefore, this code, if deployed, is buggy code. To finish this, what I need to do is make sure the JIT compiler will never inline this method call. How do I do that? By doing this. I'm going to add a using statement for system.runtime.compilerservices here. And then I'm going to go down here and decorate this method with a method impl. And it's going to be method impl options dot no inlining. Take that, Mr. JIT compiler. You are now forbidden to inline this method. And now when I run this thing, not only does it work, it's going to work every time on every platform on which Silverlight is supported. Now I'm hoping that there is a calendar over my shoulder on that screen. Am I right this time? Okay, good. Actually, I can see it right here on the stage monitors. So I know there's a calendar there. But that's how we do dynamic assembly loading. And yeah, you need to be aware of the JIT compiler because you may get into those chicken and egg problems like I did right there. But let me show you another take on dynamic assembly loading. Suppose instead of waiting for that button to be clicked, what if we wanted to just, the moment the application starts up, start immediate asynchronous downloads in the background of any and all additional assemblies the application might use. We keep the zap small that way so that the application starts up quickly. The user isn't even aware that there are background downloads taking place, and maybe we don't end up using all those assemblies depending on how the user interacts with the app, but we don't really care since we didn't diminish the user experience. But the cool thing is, if the user clicks a button or something that does now require one of those assemblies, chances are it has already been downloaded. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to do that? So I won't build this one live because it would take too long, but I do want to show you one of the samples that's in that zip file I referenced just a moment ago. This one is called Assembly Loader Service Demo. And let me open it up and show it to you. On the outside, it looks almost exactly like the application that I just built. I click a button, a calendar control is created. Once more, there is no copy of system.windows.controls.dll in the ZAP. It is being downloaded dynamically. The difference is, in this case, the moment the app starts up, it went ahead and initiated that background download. So there was actually no pause between the time I clicked the button and the calendar control got loaded. Now, let me show you what I did here. I wrote something called an assembly loader service. It's a C# class that implements an interface named iApplicationService. In fact, this thing is fairly robust. If you want to use it in your code, feel free. That's one reason I provide these samples. If this interface is not familiar to you, here's why. It was very quietly added to Silverlight 3 so that Silverlight could support client-side application services. A service is something that runs and has a lifetime greater than that of the application. If you build an application service, that service is actually started by the Silverlight runtime before your application is started, and the service isn't shut down until after the application ends. To build an application service, you simply write a C# class that implements this iApplicationService interface. Once you've done that, you can go into app.xaml, and you can declare an instance of that service this way inside the application lifetime objects property of the app. That's what actually makes it an application service and makes sure that it starts up before your application starts. Now, going back and looking at the source code, I built a simple public API into this class. The API consists of a method named loadAssemblyAsync. Now, when my application starts up or any app starts up that uses this, I can just call loadAssemblyAsync as many times as I want to have it go in and download in the background very quietly and silently all the assemblies that I might need later on. Once an assembly download has completed and the assembly has been loaded into the app domain, my assembly loader service fires an assembly loaded event. If I have UI elements that depend, for example, on one of those assemblies being loaded, I could take this event and use that opportunity to enable those UI elements. If, however, something goes wrong with the background download, then my assembly loader service fires an assembly loaded error event so I can respond in whatever way I see fit. Final piece of the puzzle is what happens when the application starts up. Here I grab a reference to that assembly loader service instance created from the XAML in my app.xaml file. Then I call loadAssemblyAsync asking it to download system.windows.controls.dll, and I register handlers for both of the events that it might fire. This makes it easy. A few lines of code now, I can begin a background download of as many assemblies as I want, and they're automatically loaded into the app domain once the download completes. There's something else here that you should be aware of. You probably know already that in Silverlight, the UI thread is very special. The UI thread can do anything in Silverlight. Background threads, on the other hand, are limited in what they can do. They are not allowed, for example, to update the visual tree or query the XAML DOM or anything like that. What's not documented is that there are other things in Silverlight that can only be done from a UI thread that have nothing to do with the UI whatsoever. For example, assemblypart.load will throw an invalid access exception if called from a background thread. So I did something else here that you may find interesting and that you might take a lesson from. In fact, I tell people at Microsoft, if you're building class libraries, you should do the same thing I've done here. If you build a service of your own, or you build class libraries that are going to be consumed by other developers, you have no control over whether the methods in your service or library are called from background threads or UI threads. In my example, with this assembly loader service, if I'm going to call assemblypart.load, I've got to make sure it's done on a UI thread. So here's what I do. When I'm called, I check to make sure that I'm running on the UI thread. If I'm not, if I was called from a background thread, I marshal out to the UI thread. A little bit more work on my part, but it gives me a much more robust service because now a developer who's using my assembly loader service doesn't have to have any specific knowledge of threading in Silverlight. They don't have to wonder, why is this thing throwing invalid access exceptions? I think, what I'm supposed to do. No, we build the intelligence into the service or the class library. Good thing to think about. Don't make developers who are using your stuff think about and be knowledgeable about threading. Instead, take care of that for them. If you want to know, if you're curious about how that's done, you can examine this source code. There's not a lot to it, just a couple of ifs here and there and a couple of calls out to go back to the UI thread. good thing to keep in mind when you're building this kind of stuff in Silverlight. Let's go back to PowerPoint for just a moment. And let's build on what we've already learned by talking about how to download Zaps dynamically. So we just saw how to download assemblies and load them dynamically, but what if we wanted to partition our application in multiple Zaps? And there are lots of reasons for doing that. A Zap file is a zip file, after all. Let's say there are 10 assemblies and 20 or 30 big images that I may need to pull down at runtime. I could package them in a Zap file, and not only will the download size be smaller since they're zipped up in there, but now I can go make one trip on the network and grab all the stuff I need without having to be chatty and make multiple trips, one per asset, to go get those things. So how could we build upon what we've already learned to do dynamic downloading of Zaps? Well, I'm going to do that for you, and you're going to see it's pretty easy. We can still use a web client to download a Zap the same way we used it to download an assembly a few moments ago. We will have to do a little bit of extra work, however, once the download finishes. Since a Zap file is a zip file, we're going to need to unpack that Zap and extract the individual files from it. Now, Silverlight will help us do that, at least to an extent. Silverlight does not have the ability internally, nor does it expose an API that lets you enumerate the contents of a zip or Zap file. But it does give you an API for extracting known files from those Zap files. That's the primary reason, by the way, that Silverlight Zap files have application manifests in them. It's through the application manifest that Silverlight discovers what else is in the Zap file. So we can do exactly what Silverlight does when it downloads a Zap. We can use its public API to extract an application manifest containing a list of all the other assemblies and resources in that Zap. Then we can build an enumerated list of those assemblies. We can extract them from the Zap file one by one using application.getResourceStream, as I'm doing in this slide, and then we can call assemblyPart.load one by one to load them into the app domain. Here is the code that, once the Zap is downloaded, extracts the application manifest, that reads it, treats it as an XML file, enumerates the assemblies, the other assemblies in the Zap. Here is the code that then takes that enumerated list, extracts the assemblies one by one, and calls assemblyPart.load. Now, it may sound like so much gobbledygook. Let me just show it to you here. In fact, what we can do is take that application that we built a few moments ago, and let's convert it so that instead of downloading raw assemblies, it downloads Zap files containing assemblies. So I'll go back to that when I called it assembly load demo. And first thing I'm going to do is get rid of that system.windows.controls.dll in there. So if I were to run it right now, it's going to fail, right? There's nothing, no assembly to download. But now I'm going to create a separate Zap that contains the assembly. Now watch what I do. I'm going to add to this Silverlight solution a new Silverlight project. Where's new project? Add. You're right. I need to scroll up. There we go. I'll add a new project. So, note this. I'm not going to choose Silverlight class library as the project type. That would create an assembly. I'm going to choose Silverlight application because that will produce a Zap. So what are we going to call this other project? We'll call it extra stuff. How about that? Now, watch what happens. And we don't need another test page. We wouldn't use it anyway. We'll click OK right there. If I build this solution right now, we should see two Zaps in the client bin folder. There it is. There's extrastuff.zap. Now, if you look at the extra stuff project, it has an app.xaml and a mainpage.xaml, like any Silverlight application project, but we don't need them, so I'm going to delete them. My purpose in creating this Zap was to use it as a container for assemblies. So I'm just going to add to its project references all the assemblies that I want to pull down. Maybe we want system.windows.controls. Maybe we're going to use a data grid, so we want some other references in there as well. So let's put system.windows.controls.data in there as well. Now, that Zap file is going to have those assemblies embedded inside it. Now, we're going to need to do a little bit more work right here, right? Since we're no longer downloading raw assemblies, we're going to need to unpack the Zap file. And to make that easy, I'm going to go back to the slides for a moment and cut and paste a little bit of code. I'll have to do some minor fix-ups, but this should make our job very easy. So let's first paste this in and talk again about exactly what it's doing. So here, once the zap is downloaded, let's see, looks like I'm going to need a couple of using statements, not surprising there. So let's go ahead and add those in. Do the same for XML reader. And I'll need to change this, which is a stream, to e.result. That's the downloaded zap, the raw bits and bytes. So we wrap a stream resource info object around the downloaded zap. Then we create an XML reader around this file right here, extracted from the zap. Then from this XML, we build an enumerated list of all of the assemblies packaged inside this zap. Now back to the slides for just a moment. Let me grab a little bit more code. I'll paste this in here. Whoops. Whoa. There we go. Yeah. Now we should be able to paste that in there, because once we've enumerated those assemblies, we need to actually extract them and load them into the app domain. So let me add this using statement. And these calls to get resource stream on the application class are actually extracting the assemblies from the zap. And here you see me calling assembly part.load to load them one by one into the app domain. So if this works now, when we run it, it should work exactly as it did before. We should be able to click the button and see it disappear and a calendar control appear. The difference is we're no longer downloading a raw assembly. Not found. Ah, yep, I need to change the URI pass to the web client, don't I? Now, some of you knew that. You just wanted to see me do an epic fail, didn't you? Extrastuff.zap. Let's see if that works a little bit better. Click the button. The calendar control appears. Now we're downloading entire zaps. Take that simple technique, and you can partition an application into as many zaps as you want to. Now, some of you may be wondering, what about MEF? What about Prism? In fact, some of you may have attended Glenn Block sessions this week. He is sometimes called Glenn the father of MEF because he was instrumental in its creation. MEF does give you the ability to download zaps dynamically. In fact, it's very cool. And I do use it all the time. There are two reasons I show people how to do it manually. One, since MEF has a cost itself, MEF is contained in two assemblies. If all you want to do is download a small zap or maybe a couple of assemblies, I would probably do it manually because I would add more to the size of the app by bringing MEF into the equation. But if the size of what I'm downloading exceeds the size of MEF significantly, I would probably just use MEF to do it. But here's another reason I like to show this. This is how MEF does it. If you've ever wondered, this is how MEF does it. There's really no magic, there's no mystery, and there's nothing preventing you from just doing it yourself. But if you already are using MEF in your application, then I would definitely go ahead and take advantage of its ability to do dynamic downloading of zaps, do recomposition, and all that. But now you can do it with or without MEF. So I want to build upon that just a little bit. Let's go back to PowerPoint to do that. By the way, I haven't been able to see any of the royal wedding today. Are they married now? Probably not. Surely they didn't get married and already split up. That wouldn't happen, would it? I don't know. They're supposed to get married around 1 or 2 o'clock or something like that. You know, my wife has a lot of friends back in the U.S. who were having royal wedding parties. They were getting up at, getting together at 4 o'clock this morning on the East Coast, 1 o'clock in the morning on the West Coast. I wouldn't get up at 4 a.m. for a wedding if it were my mother. So, I don't know. Well, maybe if it were my mother, I don't know. So, let's take this a step further. What about dynamic localization, folks? As long as we know how to download other assemblies and other zaps and stuff like that, could we apply that to localization? What if, for example, you're building localization support into a Silverlight application and you're doing it the traditional way, the way MSDN shows you how to do it using ResX files? So you add ResX files to your project, each one containing localization resources for a different culture or locale. Visual Studio builds each of those ResX files into a satellite assembly, a resources DLL. And then it packages all of those satellite assemblies in your Zap. Now, if you're doing localization for two or three languages and the localization resources are small, not a big deal to have all of those in the Zap. But I've seen Silverlight applications that localize for 10 or 15 languages and that have large localization resources, sometimes large images and things like that. I wouldn't want to make every user pay the price for downloading the satellite assemblies for all of those languages. What I would prefer to do is keep the Zap size small. Keep those satellite assemblies out. Get up and running. Figure out what language the user wants to see content in, and then go do an asynchronous download of just the satellite assembly that you need. So that's what we're going to do next. And while we're at it, we're going to take care of a couple of other problems that can be very frustrating when you're doing localization in Silverlight. One, when you're doing ResX-based localization, and I'll bet some of you have run into this, Visual Studio is kind enough to generate a Resource Manager wrapper class for you to make it easy to get at those resources programmatically or through data binding in XAML. But even if you tell Visual Studio to make all the members of that wrapper class public, thanks to a bug in Visual Studio, it leaves the constructor marked internal. That means if you make changes to those resources, you add a new one or something, you have to go back and update the code-genned code each and every time. Let's fix that while we're at it. And here's something else we're going to fix. Normally, when we're doing ResX-based localization, the way we tell the runtime what culture we want to show is by creating a culture info object and assigning it to the current thread, to its current culture and current UI culture properties. It's all fine and good. No problem with that at all. But you may have noticed that when you change those properties of the current thread, that does not magically make the content in the page that the user is viewing change to show that new culture. We don't always need that, but sometimes it would be very handy to be able to change cultures on the fly without having to reload the app or refresh the page or navigate off to another page like that. So we're going to make that happen as well. We're going to kill three birds with one stone here. And let me kind of set the stage for what you're going to see in these next two demos that I do. First off, you're going to see me using a little class I wrote called Observable Resources. This is a wrapper class for a wrapper class. I'm going to use it to wrap the resource manager wrapper that Visual Studio generates. One thing that's going to do for me is hide that ugly internal constructor so that I don't have to go back and make changes manually to code-gen code every time I change one of those darn ResX files. Another thing it's going to do is give me the ability to change cultures on the fly. Because in XAML, we traditionally use data bindings. We bind to an instance of the resource manager's wrapper, and we use data binding statements to reference properties in that wrapper. Well, if we could somehow, once we change the culture info associated with the current thread, if we could force those bindings to update, we could do on-the-fly updating of the content. Well, how do you make a binding update in XAML? You make sure the data source implements an interface named iNotifyPropertyChanged. My real reason for writing this localization resources class, and again, you're welcome to take it and use it if you want, is so that I can wrap all of my localization resources in something that has an iNotify property changed. I also build into this class a public method named updateBindings, which can be called from the outside, which will then fire a property changed event, forcing any binding that is dependent upon that localization resources instance to update itself. One other thing we're going to have to do is figure out how to enumerate satellite assemblies in a downloaded Zap file. Here's how we do that. You already know how to download a Zap with a web client, how to use application.getResourceStream to extract the application manifest, and then to extract the individual assemblies inside it. We'll do the same thing when we download a Zap containing a satellite assembly. The only difference is we'll be a little bit more selective. As we iterate through the assemblies inside, we'll look specifically for the ones that are satellite assemblies. As we identify those and as we extract them from the downloaded Zap, we will then call assemblypart.load to load them into the app domain, as you've already seen me do before, two times now. In fact, this is a cool thing about a satellite assembly. It's just an assembly as far as Core CLR is concerned. Once I have it in my hands and once I load it into the app domain with assemblypart.load, it's treated like any other assembly, meaning I can access the resources inside it. So, let's look at some code. Let's see if this really works. I want to start with a demonstration, a pre-built app, that shows how to do traditional ResX-based localization in Silverlight. I call this one Static Localization Demo. And here's what it looks like. When you run it for the first time, you'll see a simple greeting. Bienvenue, French for welcome, I think. As well as some buttons that allow you to change the culture that's being shown. Now, when I each time I click one of these buttons, like the Espanol button, what's happening under the hood is a simple event handler is creating a culture info object for, in this case, Spanish, and it's assigning that to the current thread. If I could, if I navigated off to another page right now or could somehow refresh this page, I would see the content change as well. But because we're using static data bindings right now, we don't see any update at all. However, if I were to go into app.xaml and when the application starts up, change the culture info object assigned to the current thread, here I'm commenting out the line of code that was creating a culture info object for French. Now I'll be using my default localization resources, which are English. Then you see that show up. But now notice here, to do the localization, I have four ResX files, one for German, one for Spanish, one for French, and one for English. Three of those four are being built into satellite assemblies and packaged in my Zap. In even this simple application, I'm making every user download all of those resources. So let's see if we can fix that. Let me introduce you to version 2 of this app, which is called Dynamic Localization Demo. When I run this one, it's going to look initially the same on the outside. I think I'd probably bring this up in English first. Yep. But watch this. I'm going to do on-the-fly localization. I click the French button without any tricks, without any refreshes, reloads. The content changes on the fly. More importantly, the Zap file that was downloaded when this application started only contains the English resources. The moment the user clicked that French button, I went and downloaded a Zap containing the satellite assembly with the French localization resources. Now, no user had to pay the price for all of these localization resources to be pulled down. Let me show you the highlights of this code real quickly here. First off, in the main project, you see I only have one ResX file, the one containing my default or English resources. I've added another project to the solution named External Resources. It is a Silverlight application project, meaning when it's built, it creates a Zap file named externalresources.zap. In fact, you can see that externalresources.zap in my client bin folder here. Now, I've chosen to put the satellite assemblies for German, Spanish, and French resources in externalresources.zap in real life. I probably wouldn't overload it that way. I would create a separate project for each set of localization resources. That way, if I wanted, say, Spanish resources, I could download maybe SpanishResources.zap and not have to pull down German and French resources as well. But here, I put the German, French, and Spanish resources in the same Zap just for demonstration purposes so that you could go download one Zap and have the resources that you need. Now, let me show you something else here about this project. Here is that observable resources class that I mentioned. In fact, this is basically identical to what you saw on the slides. Remember, I used this to wrap the wrapper class that Visual Studio generated. Why? Number one, it hides that internal public constructor in the Visual Studio generated code. Number two, since it implements iNotify property change, that's why I called it observable resources, by the way, kind of like observable collection. When a data binding object using one of these as a data source sees a property changed event fire, it will reevaluate the binding. It'll go grab new resources and propagate them over to the data target. That is the crux of why I was able to click a button and change resources on the fly. Now, I did something else that just to abstract this out a little bit more. I built a little class named Localization Manager. I did not build this to be really generic, so you're free to use it, but you'll find that I have some application-specific logic in here. You'll probably want to make it a little more generic. But it is this class that knows which resources or which satellite assemblies live in which ZAP file. So when that French button is clicked, for example, my main application doesn't go and directly download the other ZAP. It calls out to Localization Manager and says, uh-oh, I need French resources. Can you go find them for me? Localization Manager knows which ZAP those resources live in, downloads it, pulls out the satellite assemblies, and loads them into the app domain. In fact, right here, Localization Manager also exposes a public method named change culture. That makes the code in mainpage.xaml.cs pretty simple. Here is the event handler that executes when the user clicks one of those buttons to change from one language to another. All I do is call change culture on the localization manager, saying we now want French resources or Spanish resources. Localization manager keeps a record of the external ZAPs it has downloaded. If it's asked to load resources for a ZAP it hasn't already downloaded, then it fires up a web client, does the download, cracks it open, loads the satellite assemblies into the app domain. Once that's done, it fires a culture changed event. You can see that I've already wired up a handler to that culture changed event using a simple lambda expression here. I'm calling update bindings on that observable resources object to tell all of my data bindings to update. So with just a little bit of work, you have potentially much, much greater efficiency. No one has to download localization resources that they don't need. Most users, in truth, are never going to want to see that content in more than one language, correct? This is how we do dynamic localization in Silverlight. But you know what? While we're talking about how to do dynamic stuff, hey, there's more we can do. Let me tell you another area in which dynamic loading can be very, very interesting. And that is dynamic page loading. Silverlight 3 was the first version of Silverlight to include for us something called the navigation framework. Ostensibly, the navigation framework was added to help us write multi-page Silverlight applications. And indeed, it accomplishes that goal pretty well. We can add multiple pages to our app. We can make calls to methods like navigationService.navigate to navigate from one page to another. And when we do that, something interesting happens. You see, the navigation framework wasn't added solely for the purpose of allowing us to build multi-page applications. Back in the Silverlight 2 timeframe, the Silverlight team was getting quite a number of complaints from customers saying that, number one, the back button doesn't work in Silverlight and it's killing us. Can you guys do something about that? The other big complaint they were getting is that Silverlight content wasn't searchable. It wasn't indexable. There was no good way to do deep linking. So if you had a Silverlight app, for example, that allowed the user to interact with it, maybe a fractal viewer, for example. Let's say in that fractal viewer, you drill down and you find some really cool pattern. You want to share it with a friend. You'd like to email a link to a friend. But as you're clicking and interacting with the app, nothing in the browser's address bar is changing. Therefore, there's no link you can mail. If you just take what's in the browser's address bar and email it to a friend, they will see the application in its default state, not the state you saw it in. The navigation framework is actually a solution to all three of those problems. Not only does it let you build multi-page applications, but each time you navigate from one page to another, the navigation framework interacts with the host browser and adds a node to the browser's history cache. So now as you navigate from page 1 to 2 to 3, the user can hit the browser's back button to go back to page 2 and back to page 1 and so forth and so on. By the way, you can also pass data in the URL that identifies these other pages and use that to achieve deep linking. So the navigation framework, I think, is one of the most underrated parts of Silverlight. It solved three big problems. In fact, it's so important that when you build a Silverlight for phone application, that is, when you create the application, Visual Studio gives you a navigation application without even asking you about it. That is the default template for phone projects. So why does this concern us? Well, here's why it concerns us. When you build a navigation application and you add pages to it, those pages by default are embedded in your application zap file. If you have a small navigation app with 5 or 10 pages, you probably don't care. It's not increasing the size of the zap that much unless those pages are very resource heavy. But if the pages are resource heavy, or if there are lots of pages, sometimes these navigation applications have hundreds of pages, in an application like that, you may not want to force the user to download every page. If you could keep some pages out of this app and download them in the background, you could get the application up and running quickly. Furthermore, if which pages are actually shown might depend on how the user interacts with the app. In other words, if it's, you know, a workflow type app, and if the user clicks one button, they go to page 2. If they click another button, they bypass that page and others and go straight to page 10. Why make them pay the price for downloading a zap with pages they may never see? So the question becomes, how can we apply what we know about dynamic localization, dynamic assembly loading, dynamic zap loading, and everything else to navigation applications? And here's the answer. In Silverlight 4, the team quietly introduced a new interface to the runtime. That interface is called iNavigation Content Loader. A lot of people are aware of this, but a lot are not. But it's arguably one of the most important infrastructural interfaces you can know about in Silverlight. Here's what it does. If you are willing to write a class that implements the interface, you can take over the loading of pages in a navigation application for Silverlight. If you don't implement that interface, then Silverlight does the page loading for you, but Silverlight only knows how to pull pages out of the local zap. If you do build an iNavigation content loader, you can load them from anywhere. And in fact, the interface was designed with asynchronous networking in mind. It is relatively easy to build one that goes out and fetches pages dynamically from the network or somewhere else. You can even, if you wanted, with this interface, literally build the pages on the fly using reflection or something else as they're requested. There are almost endless possibilities. Now, here's what the interface looks like on this slide and the next. It's a fairly simple interface, 4 methods if I remember correctly. Ostensibly, there's not a lot of work to be done. The devil's in the details, of course. There's usually quite a fair amount of work involved in implementing one of these, but I'm going to show you a real-world one, and I think you'll agree we get a lot of bang for the buck. But let me tell you what I'm doing in the example in this slide and the next. Silverlight 4 introduced an internal, public infrastructural class called Page Resource Content Loader. That is the Silverlight Runtime's default implementation of iNavigation Content Loader. And that's the one that's loading pages in a navigation app if you don't provide your own implementation of the interface. In this so-called do-nothing content loader, I'm providing my own custom content loader. Notice the interface that it implements. But all I'm doing is wrapping an instance of Page Resource Content Loader. So this one doesn't yet allow me to do external downloads of pages. It just wraps Page Resource Content Loader. But it does show what's involved in terms of implementing methods in implementing this interface. The most important method in the interface is begin load. That's the one that's called when the user navigates from one page to another, or you programmatically navigate them from one page to another. That's where, in your content loader, you go out and find the page that the framework wants to show next and deliver it back to the framework so that it can display it. Once you've built a custom content loader, you need to register it with the runtime so that it will be used in lieu of Silverlight's own Page Resource Content Loader. Doing that is very simple. You create an instance of your content loader, either declaratively, as I'm doing here, or programmatically, and you assign it to the content loader property added to the frame class in Silverlight 4. Now, you are responsible for loading these pages in response to each navigation event. The system will no longer help you. So let's take a look at an example. By sheer coincidence, I happen to have a project here that demonstrates how to do dynamic page loading. It is called Dynamic Navigation Demo. And here's what it looks like. It's a 3-page application. In fact, it's very simple. And on the outside, there's absolutely no evidence that it's any different from any Silverlight navigation application. Here you're looking at page one. I'll click the next button. Under the hood, I'm calling navigationservice.navigate to go to page two. I'll click next again to go to page three, and I can do that on and on and on. So no difference on the outside, but what's interesting about this is if you look in this project, there is only one page defined there. Page one, the very first page that the user saw. Where do pages two and three come from? They live in an external zap file in this project right here. I called external pages. You can see them here and here. When this application first started up, pages two and three hadn't even been downloaded. The first time the user clicked a button to display one of those pages or to navigate to it, that's when I did the external download to go download the assembly that contains those pages. Now, let me show you something here. Before we look at the code for my content loader, something you may find interesting. I wanted to make this really, really simple. I wanted to come up with a syntax that would make it simple. So take a look here. Here's my frame control, and I'm creating a URI mapper, which we use to map virtual URIs to physical URIs in navigation applications. Look at the three pages that I've mapped. The mapped URI for page one is very conventional, but the mapped URI for pages two and three use a very special syntax. It's just something arbitrary that I came up with. When you preface the page with slash ext and the URI of an external assembly, this tells my content loader that these pages don't live in the main zap but must be downloaded on the fly. There's logic in my content loader to prevent redundant downloads. It knows, for example, once it has downloaded an assembly for page two, that page two can be shown again without the assembly being redownloaded. It also uses reflection to look inside each assembly that it downloads so that if you download an assembly containing page two and that assembly also happens to contain page three, and then the navigation framework asks for page three, it knows that it doesn't have to download that assembly again. If you look at the source code, you'll find that I've got a couple of private dictionaries in my content loader class. That's where I'm keep tracking of things like which assemblies have already been downloaded and which types, which pages live inside those assemblies. Now, I won't go through it line for line, but I will hit a couple of the highlights so that you can see what you're looking at if you choose to look at it yourself. Dynamic Content Loader is my iNavigation Content Loader application, or implementation, I should say. Here are the dictionaries that let my content loader remember which assemblies have been downloaded and which page types exist in those assemblies. By the way, you may not know this, but let me tell you this. In the big .NET framework, there's a rather rich app domain API. In a normal .NET application, you could, for example, ask the runtime what assemblies are loaded into that app domain. That API does not exist in Silverlight. There is a small app domain API in Silverlight, but it is impossible in Silverlight today, and this may change in the future, by the way, but it is impossible today to enumerate assemblies loaded into an app domain. That's why whenever we build stuff like this in Silverlight, we usually end up keeping track manually of what we've downloaded and loaded into the app domain. Of course, if you have multiple entities like that at work and they don't know what each other is downloading, there's no way to prevent maybe two different loaders from attempting to load the same assembly into the app domain. The good news is it's not harmful. Silverlight itself knows which assemblies have been loaded, and if you try to load the same assembly a second time, it's basically no op. Silverlight will just ignore it. In the future, we may well be able to enumerate those assemblies. We'll see. Anyway, begin load is the heart of any custom content loader. Here's what I'm doing here. I know what page the framework has asked for, but I need to know whether the assembly that implements that page is in memory, in the app domain. If not, I need to go download that assembly and load it into the app domain. So I'm going through several checks here. First, I'm seeing, for example, is that assembly already loaded into the app domain? If so, I just use reflection to create an instance of the type representing the page that the navigation framework has asked for. If not, then I have to resort to other means. I have to go download the assembly. You can see that beginning right here. And once the async download has completed, then I need to munge around in the assembly to find the CLR type that represents the page that has been requested. I use a bit of a hack to do that, but it does work reliably. And then at the end, I actually load that thing into the app domain. If you look a little further down, you'll see that happening. Bottom line here is, I've done my best to encapsulate this. Now, if you find yourself in the position of building rather large navigation applications and you want to take advantage of dynamic assembly loading, just pull my dynamic content loader out and use it. As far as I know, it's bug-free, but I can't promise that, so user beware. Do me a favor, if you use it and you find bugs, let me know, okay? I'd like to know, that way I can correct them for the next conference audience. But as far as I know, it's bug-free. All right. One last thing here that has nothing to do with dynamic loading that I want to throw out at you. One of the features of Silverlight that I think is incredibly important that isn't used often enough, sometimes because we don't know about it, it is the behavior. So a little bit of background on this. At Microsoft, where there's a lot of Silverlight development work ongoing right now, as you can probably imagine, in fact, a lot of Silverlight development work. Some of the Silverlight projects they're working on are quite large, and many of the teams that are working on these projects consist of designers and developers. And that kind of makes sense because, you know, I'm a developer. I'm not a real artsy person. I'm not really good at crafting beautiful UIs. I'm better at sitting at my desk and writing C# code in Visual Studio. Designers, on the other hand, have a different set of skills. They may not be very comfortable or even comfortable at all in Visual Studio writing C# code, but they have great artistic skills, and they can build these beautiful UIs for us. And it's important that designers and developers work together. In fact, in today's world where everything is driven by the web and users expect beautiful web-looking UIs, it's more important than ever to have those designers working with you to build great applications. But I've also observed something, both inside and outside Microsoft. Now, I know you may find this hard to believe, but sometimes designers and developers don't get along. Sometimes they actually fight. It's a good thing that we don't do duels anymore like we did 200 years ago, right? There may be some dead designers and developers. In fact, I've seen the friction between designers and developers cause great hardships for projects. And in looking at why, what I found was that very often those developers don't really understand what the designers are doing or how they do it. And vice versa. A lot of designers really don't understand what you and I as developers do. At Microsoft, in some groups, they've defined a new role, sometimes called the integrator. The integrator is a rare individual who understands both design and development. An integrator can look at the UI requirements for an application. They can pick out and say, you know, this is going to be really hard for a designer to do. This is going to be next to impossible. But if these developers over here would do a little bit of work, they could make that really easy. That not only helps the project do better, but it increases its chance of success, reduces friction, and all of that. In fact, I have a daughter who is turning 18 next weekend. She goes off to college next year, and she's interested in graphic design. She's somewhat interested in programming and stuff. And I'm telling her, the real sweet spot in coming years, I think, is those people who have design and development skills. So I'm encouraging her to study graphic design and computer science. Now, if you have a teenage daughter, you'll know why I say this. She'll probably ignore me. In fact, the fact that I'm recommending that's probably dooming any chances she'll ever do it. But you know how it is, though. When you're a father or a mother to a teenager, you're pretty dumb, right? But as they get older and you get older, you just get smarter and smarter and smarter. I've learned that the hard way. It's funny, my son is 20 years old. He's in college. He's a sophomore in college this year. And he called me a couple of months ago, and he said, Dad, he said, we need to talk. I said, okay. I thought, oh, well, what's coming here? He said, Dad, I just don't understand women. And I said, well, son, get used to it. Because I'm 50 years old, I've been married for almost 30 years. I don't understand them either. It's kind of fun to see your kids come along like that. And anyway, we are going to, I digress, don't I? We are going to make sure that these designers and developers get along. And what is your first and most important tool for doing that? It is the behavior. Because behaviors allow us to encapsulate in C# cool things that make UI elements interactive. I mean, just a simple example is a bubbling mouse over. Let's say you've got a bunch of icons at the bottom of your scene. And the UI requirements say that as the mouse cursor passes over those icons, they need to bubble up and then bubble back down when the cursor leaves them. Now, that's not hard for a developer to do. What we would do probably is create a couple of animations. One to increase the size of the icon, another to decrease it. We would register handlers for certain mouse events like mouse enter and mouse leave. We would apply a scale transform to each of the icons, and when we see the mouse enter the icon, we would launch an animation that animates the scale transform to make the icon get larger, and when we see the cursor leave the icon, we would launch an animation that manipulates the scale transform to make the icon revert to its original size. That may be no big deal for a developer. It may be a big deal for a designer, depending on how really competent they are. And I'm going to show you some examples of things where no designer in the world could do what I want to do in this UI. However, if you as a developer are willing to encapsulate this tough stuff in behaviors, then for a designer, it becomes a simple matter of dragging that behavior out onto the artboard in Blend and dropping it into a UI element. Now, how do you write a behavior? In fact, what is a behavior? Really, a behavior is nothing more than a class that derives from the behavior base class, which is in system.windows.interactivity.dll. That assembly is actually part of Blend, not Silverlight, but may become a part of Silverlight someday because it's almost a de facto part of it today. To build a behavior, you derive from that class. If you use the templated version, as I'm doing here, you're actually helping Blend out. Because I'm passing in a UI element as a template parameter, that tells Blend that this behavior can be attached to any UI element. That could be a rectangle, a media element, or anything else. If you were to build a behavior that could only be applied to layout controls, however, like a canvas or a grid, you could pass panel as that template parameter because panel is the base class for all layout controls. And then if a designer working in Blend attempted to drag that behavior out onto, say, a rectangle, which does not derive from panel, Blend would tell them, sorry, but this behavior cannot be applied to that type of UI element. Then, in deriving from the behavior-based class, you inherit a couple of very important virtual methods, on attached and on detaching. Your job in on attached is to do whatever you need to do to get this behavior up and running and ready to go, then to reverse that, to release its resources in on detaching. In this simple example here, notice I call this disappear behavior. The idea is that when this behavior is attached to a UI element, I want a click of that UI element with the mouse to make the element disappear. So in my behaviors on attached method, I register a handler for mouse left button down events. Notice I'm registering that on something called associated object. That's a property I inherit from the behavior base class that identifies the UI element that this behavior is attached to. In the event handler, I toggle the visibility property of that UI element to visibility.collapse to make it go away. It's an incredibly simple example, trivially simple example, but it actually works and it shows the basics of behaviors. Then we can apply these behaviors declaratively. Visual Studio won't do this for you. You could type the XAML in by hand. But if it's a designer working with this behavior in Blend and he or she drags that behavior out and drops it onto an element on the artboard, it is XAML exactly like this that is being generated by Blend. If you prefer not to do it in Blend, there's no reason that you couldn't do it yourself. Let me show you really quickly a couple of demos and then we will be finished. So I want to open a project in another folder called Mouse Over Behavior Demo. And here's what this thing looks like. It's pretty simple. It's a little image viewer. Oops, wrong one. It shows a stack of rectangles. As the mouse passes over them, you can see that they bubble up and down. And to make that happen, I'm doing exactly what I described a few moments ago. I've got animations, scale transforms, mouse enter and mouse leave events. But to make that kind of interactivity incredibly easy for a designer, I wrote something called bubbling mouse over behavior, which looks like this. And I won't go through all the code here, but you can see that I did derive from the behavior base class. I said this can be applied to any UI element. In onAttached, I'm setting the stage for everything. I'm registering handlers for mouse enter and mouse leave events. I'm adding a scale transform to the object if there's not a scale transform there already. I'm programmatically creating the animations that are going to be used to animate the scale X and scale Y properties of the transform to make it get larger and smaller. And then finally, I trigger those animations in response to mouse enter and mouse leave events. Again, for a designer, applying this is no more difficult than dragging this behavior out and dropping it onto an element on the artboard. But let me show you one last example, something that would be next to impossible for a non-developer to do. I'm going to open a project called Magnifier Behavior Demo. And here's what it looks like when it runs. You'll see Doobie the Penguin here, all rendered out in XAML. But when you click the left mouse button, a virtual magnifying glass pops up. Whoops, went too far. And you can drag it around. You can see all the little parts of Doobie. Because Doobie is all defined in XAML, which is all about vectors, we get infinite scalability and things like that. Now, let me tell you first a little bit about how we do UI tricks like that in Silverlight. What I'm doing is, when I see the left mouse button go down, I'm using Silverlight's writable bitmap.render method to make a bitmap image copy of Doobie. But when I call writable bitmap.render, I'm also passing in a scale transform that makes the copy four times larger, that is in width and height, than the original. So I have this big scaled up bitmap rendition of Doobie that the user doesn't even see. But then, also in response to that left mouse click, I create a circular clipping region and I expose a small part of that large bitmap that I've created. And as the cursor moves around the page, I'm continually moving that clipping region, and the end result is I create the illusion that we're looking at that through a virtual magnifying glass. Now, even the first time I wrote that, it took me a while to get it all working. So I thought, you know what? This is a great example of something I could do with a behavior. So that's what I did. I put all of that logic out in something called Magnifier Behavior. There's a lot of stuff here. I won't go through it line for line since we're almost out of time anyway. But I also made it programmable. If you open this thing up in Blend, you'll see that there are properties named Zoom Factor and Lens Radius. That allows a designer, if they want that image that's being created, the one that's viewed through the magnifying glass, to be larger or smaller, they could set the zoom factor to 2, and what's seen through the virtual magnifying glass would be 2 times larger than, rather than 4 times the original. With lens radius, that also allows the designer to specify the radius of that circular clipping region that the user sees as a lens. So all of this logic is encapsulated in there. It's a great example to study if you're interested in writing behaviors of your own. And this is all part of that zip file. I want to close out the session by bringing that URI back up there. I'll make sure that this is active for at least a few weeks. So if you want these samples and all the others I've shown here, feel free to download the zip file. And for the first time this week, I've actually finished 1 minute early. Great way to end the week, isn't it? Let me just say, folks, I hope you've had a great week here. I hope it's been a great event for you. It's always an honor to get to come over and work with you and with the Microsoft folks here. So thanks again for inviting me, and I hope to see you again next year. Thank you so much.